Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
How are you doing, Russ?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Doing good. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, that's a pleasure. So what have you been up to?
You know, we just finished a Kickstarter on last Thursday, and now I'm waiting for my editor to get back with notes for my last book. And then I will start writing the next book in this series, which is due out in 2021.
Nice. The Godfather series? Is that the one you're talking about?
I have written the fifth book in that series, and that's the next book that my editor's working on. But this is a new book series that I'm working on called The Obsidian Spindle Saga.
Can you tell them, say a little bit more about that, or is it like a hush-hush kind of thing?
I probably shouldn't talk about the Obsidian Spindle Saga yet. I can say that it's a combination of fairy tales, Lovecraft, and mythology, which is kind of my thing, is sort of mythology and monsters. So yes, it's very much in that zone, but a little bit broader than I've been writing before. So I finished three books in it already. I need to write the fourth, and then that will be out, I believe, in January of 2021. Nice. And then the fifth book in the Godsverse should be out in June of 2020. And then I will write the sixth book in that series, assuming that the fifth book does well.
Nice. What got you started like your interest into like writing about monsters and mythology?
So I'm a lapsed Catholic. I grew up with a lot of religion in my life. My dad had gone to minor seminaries. My mom had went to church every week. I was confirmed, which is like after 13 years in the Catholic Church, they kind of call you a full-blown member of the Catholic Church. And then my mom afterwards said, well, I got you confirmed, and now you're on your own pretty much if you want to continue with religion. And I wasn't much for Catholicism or Christianity, but I did have a lot of burning questions, like what really is out there, and that led me to Eastern religion and paganism and just like, where do we come from, what else is out there, and my interest is in smashing a lot of mythology together, so Greek and Roman and Christian and Norse and Egyptian, and what you find across all of them is there's a lot of commonality. And so the Godsverse specifically, but pretty much all of my work is about sort of twisting mythology and monsters and using them for my own ends to tell a much bigger story.
Nice. Sounds like me. Sounds like all that stuff. I went deep into like mythology too. It's really, it's like the old like sand, like before Egypt stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. The more you look into it, the more similarities that you see between a lot of religions and the stories that they tell. And Christianity is really at its base just like mixing up a lot of religions also. Yeah. You know, Ishtar for the birth of Jesus, and then pagan Christmas trees, and kind of like a best of all the other religions. So if you study Christianity and Catholicism for long enough, it's bound to bring you down this other mythology rabbit hole, because as Christianity spread, they sort of incorporated all of these things from other religions into them to make to make it palatable for the locals in the areas that the Romans conquered.
Yeah, they were, if I remember, like, they had a little trouble, like, converting people to Catholicism. So they had to adopt a lot of paganism stuff into their traditions.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Like, the Christmas tree is a big one. But what would happen would be the Romans would march into and capture another area, and they would not get buy-in from the people in that area to adopt Christianity. And so they would sort of adopt pieces of their local customs and religions into Christianity, which is where you get a lot of the best myths. You know, the Easter Bunny comes from another religion that was incorporated into it. Jesus probably, if he was a human, was born in March, not December. But December is a very important time to a lot of pagans. And so we get all of these sort of things smashed together when it comes to Christianity as well. I've always been sort of plagued by this question of, like, why are we here, and kind of like, what is the truth of what's out there? Yeah. And all of my work on some level is about answering that question, whether it's I have a book called Worst Thing in the Universe, which is narrated by God. I have books about aliens and monsters and all sorts of mythology, but at the end it really is like it's really trying to answer that question of, like, what really is out there, and my struggle with my own faith and spirituality and religion. I think that's why even people who are religious can sort of at least respect my work, even if they don't agree with it, because it doesn't come across as, you know, blasphemous or anti-religion. It's really like an earnest pursuit of what I believe the truth is, and what and my struggle to figure out what the truth is.
Like, I think everyone goes through that a lot. If you're not, they're like really in their head. Like, I think you have to, like, really question everything.
Yeah, I mean, I know some people come to it quite early about being. Some people are quite early and they understand, they grasp their faith quite early. But it's still, for most of us, I think we struggle with it for our entire lives. Even the ones of us who are devout Catholics or Jews or Muslim or Hindi or whatever it is, I think the majority of people, even that believe in a religion, are still struggle with some of the tenets of it. And I think maybe that's why people are drawn to my work. I mean, that's the best sort of guess that I have at this point, because otherwise it's quite sacrilegious to talk about how God is really a vain drunk named Bacchus and all of that the devil may not be the bad guy, and that, like, all of these things are out there. So but I do get a pretty good reception from religious people, which I did not expect. I went to Salt Lake City last year, which is the home of the Mormon religion. I expected to get, like, drawn and quartered up there, as my books are all about, like, questioning Catholicism, and I'm quite progressively liberal, and I was surprised at how open-minded they were to trying my work, even though it's not anti-religion, but it's certainly not, like, pro Catholicism either, or pro Christianity either.
Do you ever have trouble, like, when you're writing the middle of a book, like, where to take it in the plot or anything like that?
I used to have a lot more trouble with it when I first started writing. So my you know, my first books, they took quite a long time. They would take maybe a year or more. There are two kinds of writers. The people that like have an outline, they call plotters, and the ones that just kind of don't, they call pantsers. And I used to be quite a pantser, where I would just go by the seat of my pants, and it that works for standalone books, I think. Because you don't have to have the world doesn't have to make sense outside of that singular book. But once I started writing in series, it became a lot more necessary for me to hunker down and start plotting out things to make sure that there was internal consistency and logic within each book. And once I started plotting books, at first I hated it because I was like, the magic is gone. But now it really made my I could really write a lot quicker. So I used to write maybe 500 or 1,000 words a day. And once I started plotting and really working on it, I can now write about 5,000 words a day, which is where I'm paced at. And because of the way that I plot, I still give myself a lot of latitude. But the hardest part is the outline phase. When it comes to figuring out what the plot's going to be. But also, when you're doing a big book series, you kind of want to take things in many different angles, and you're often not able to because of the internal logic that you created in earlier books. So it becomes a lot harder for me to get excited about each book because it's not about the discovery anymore. It becomes more maintenance. You know, you're with the same characters a lot. You're with the same you're telling a similarly paced story, even if it's not a similarly plotted story. But there is also comfort in going back to the characters that you know so well. You end up being able to write books quite a bit faster. And once you know who the characters are, I think the plots become a lot easier. You'll either say, if you're doing a standalone kind of book in a series, you'll either say, okay, I know that this person is a detective, or this person is going to fall in love by the end, or this is the kind of book it is. It's sort of like I have the Gods versus very fantasy thriller. So, you know, I know that it's going to be like world ending stakes or universe ending stakes. And I know that the characters are going to be do X, Y, and Z, and this is how they interact with the world. So you end up knowing the kinds of stories that you can tell, which makes it easier. Or with a series like the Obsidian Spindle Saga, you know where you ended the last book. So, you know how far in each book you get. So you kind of know where they're starting. And you know where you want them to end, each character. And so I'm about the fourth book in this series kind of ends the first coda of this series, which I intend to be about 16 books or so long. So I know that by the end of book four, I have to resolve all of the plot threads that have been building up for the previous four books. Yeah. And each book is kind of like that, you know. I put someone in peril and then like get them out and then set up threads for the next book. And I know that they have to get to a certain place by the next book or in order for the audience to be satisfied. So now that I've written five books in the Godsverse and three books in the Obsidian Spindle Saga, it becomes a lot easier to at least see where the plot is and to know where I have to go because I have a roadmap.
Nice. Is writing graphic novels a little bit different from writing a novel?
It can be. I actually think they're very similar if you like plotting. The nice thing about writing a graphic novel is that you can, because you know how long a chapter, an issue is, so my issues tend to be 20 pages long. Yeah. I can actually work out to end, so I can go from I can write page one, page two, page three, page four, page five, all the way up to page 20, and I can actually write what happens on page 1 and page 20 and work sort of inward to page 10 if I wanted to. So if I'm having trouble knowing what happens between those two points, when I'm writing a graphic novel, often I will say, well, this is where it starts, this is where it ends, and now we have to work inward toward the middle. You can't really do that with a... I can't do that with a novel, at least, because there's so much discovery in a novel, even though I plot it. So that is the main issue. The other thing difference is that a novel is meant to be read in its current form. Yeah. So I can give anybody the novel once the editing is done, and they will at least understand what happens. But for a comic book, that's not the final form. I can't give anybody the script because it wouldn't make sense. A lot of a comic book is just sort of like a blueprint of what the final is going to be. It's a lot of me giving notes to the artist, and so like I will say something like, make sure there's a knife present that we can see in this panel because it will pay off later, which is something you would never do in a book because like you want to hold that back for the reader until it's necessary. But for a comic, you're really giving a blueprint to the artist, and then the artist is drawing the final pages. So when I finish a script, I can only send it to so many people who understand how to read comic book scripts. I can't send that to my wife, for instance. So it's quite a bit different also in that when you're writing the comic script, you are not the final arbiter of what the final thing is going to do. It is a collaboration between you and the artist. So it's more analogous to writing a movie script, but even then, you're writing a movie script and many people will read it. Your managers, your agents, executives, so you have to make it like flow. And even if I gave a movie script to my wife, she would at least understand what was happening, even if it was not the most fun experience, where a comic script is really like page 1, panel 1. Here is what happens in the scene. Here is the dialogue. Page 1, panel 2. Here is what happens. Here is the dialogue. It is quite boring and stilted. So you have to know that for a novel, you're writing what the end product will be. And for a comic, you're really giving a blueprint to the artist of what they're going to be writing. And so it has to be, what they're going to be drawing. So it has to be very, very, very clear. So clear that it's almost, it gives everything away on that page so that the artist can understand what you're going for.
Nice. So it's like writing novel is like you're writing as a voice or narrator. And for comic book, you're like giving instructions for the artist, right?
Absolutely, that's exactly right. And you have to think of it that way as well. They're two very different mindsets, and it's often hard because you're writing the dialogue as it will be read by somebody, but the script is quite a bit stilted. So you're also like, I end up rewriting a lot of dialogue once I see the final pages because they end up looking so different than what I imagined, or just when I see them. What ends up happening a lot of times with a comic strip is I will overwrite the dialogue because I want the artist to get the facial expression right. But once I see the page, I realize that facial expression conveys 90% of what I wanted to from the dialogue, so I end up cutting a lot of it. So it really is a collaboration between the two people, and until you actually get the final lettering done, there's a lot of back and like I changed the script quite a bit, less now because I'm a much more confident comic book writer now than I once was, but even now I find myself changing the dialogue. Very much like if you're making a movie, you end up changing the dialogue on the day, potentially on the day you're shooting, because it doesn't feel right when it comes out of the actor's mouth.
Oh, what was it like getting your first book deal?
It was awesome. I talk a lot about it with other writers, how it like, how writers feel like it finally validates you as a, I don't think you need a book deal to feel validated. That being said, when I got my first book deal, I did feel like, well, maybe I was on the right track. My first deal was Ichabod, and I, Ichabod Jones Monster Hunter, the book that we're in production on now for the third volume. And, it really made me feel like maybe I wasn't crazy to like make this book. And then I got a book deal for a novel, and I was like, oh, maybe like I am a better novelist than I think that I am. Right now, because like somebody else is like willing to take the chance on me. Now I came to realize that that's ridiculous, and like you validate yourself, and like you end up making a lot of bad deals if you you end up making a lot of bad deals if you rely on a publisher to validate you. I know I did, and I know a lot of people do on their first couple of book deals, because they're just so excited to get a publishing deal. And to feel that level of validation, and then to have something come out with like someone else's logo on it. So you're like, oh, look at me. I'm a somebody. But I've since learned that there's a lot of predatory practices in this industry, in publishing, specifically built upon that same idea of like, well, we know you're an artist, and we know you're going to be seeking validation. So we're going to use that to give you a much worse deal than we probably should. Not every publisher is like that, but certainly that first deal felt like that level of validation. And it was only later that I realized that it was a false sense of validation, and that I was the person who was really... I should be putting faith in myself, not waiting for somebody else to put faith in me.
Yeah, because you're doing all the work. You're just...
Yeah, I mean, that's why I pulled all of my rights back from all of my books. 99. Sometimes I do anthology projects for somebody, or I'll write something if someone's paying me specifically to write something for them. Yeah. But I pretty much only write for my company, Wannabe Press, and I then control all of the rights to that. And I pulled all the rights for most of my books back into Wannabe Press specifically for that reason.
How's publishing like books changed since like the internet has started? Since like everything like on ebooks and everything.
It certainly has democratized things quite a bit. It allows a lot of everybody to write and publish their work. There's no gatekeepers anymore. Of course, that's a good thing and a bad thing. The bad part is there's a lot of terrible books out there now that need editing. There's a lot of books that should never have been released or needed to go through severe editing. And it's a lot harder to stand out now than it's ever been before, which is why it's even more important to build your audience and be out there promoting yourself and really doing the hard work of promoting and marketing your book. Also, publishers have become much more reluctant to put marketing dollars behind a book. So it used to be even a mid-list author who wasn't a big name could, they could make a good living on, on releasing books. And now there are so many books out there that it's sort of drowned out everyone but the most popular authors at a publishing company, at least. And now publishing companies don't really put any money behind any books except for their like big sellers. So it's much more individualistic now. But the good news is that it also allows so many more voices to be in, to be heard that that were never being heard before. And so many, it offers so many people the chance to make a living, and so many people a chance to build a fan base, and so many more different kinds of voices to get into the game than ever before.
I was looking at your book covers, man. Who did your, they're awesome book covers. Who did your art for your books?
The ones for the Godsverse and the Obsidian Spindle Saga were all done by the creative Paramita, who is an amazing book cover designer and criminally underutilized by people in the fantasy genre. I also have book covers by other artists. The book cover for Sorry for Existing was done by Sarah Rose. The book cover for The Vessel was done by Lee Cosey, who's a very famous Star Wars watercolorist. And most of them were done by Creative Paramita, because I really just love her style and what she brings to the process. And her book covers feel like vibrant and alive in a way that I don't see a lot in books. A lot of book covers are exactly the same as every other book. And my goal is to be similar to other books, but also wholly unique. And I think her work is both similar to what else is out there, but also wholly unique as well.
Definitely. Really beautiful.
Thank you. And those are like the fifth or sixth covers that have been on those books. So the Godsverse books specifically have been quite difficult to get right. I've released them as single books. I've released them as collections. I've released them. I must have like 20 covers for those books at this point. But I feel like we finally got it right the last time through, which is when we finally re-released them in January. We saw a huge surge in new sales that we haven't ever before. So I'm very happy with how it. I'm very happy with the new covers. So thank you for saying that.
Well, very welcome. So, what's it called? How should I get into these monsters? I forget the word. Where you like go into something?
Transition.
Yeah.
Want to talk about some Minnesota monsters?
Yeah, let's do that.
Cool. I did some, but I did a bunch of research before this to find sort of the best monsters. I think my favorite one is Pepe.
Yeah.
Pepe is the sort of Lake Pepin Loch Ness monster. Yeah. So I really love that there's like a Loch Ness monstery thing in Minnesota, or in right by about 60 miles downstream of Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Oh, that was great. I think it's like a lake monster in like every lake in every state that I've done so far.
Yeah.
There's a lake monster. Like all the great lakes. There's Pepe and there's Alti and a whole bunch of them.
It's awesome. I don't do that much work with cryptids, honestly. I don't. I deal mostly with mythological monsters, like from like actual mythology. So it's really interesting to go and find these more like local legendy kind of monsters, and the more like sort of down to earth monsters that don't necessarily have a bunch of magical powers. They just kind of like exist in this local folklore.
Yeah, it's like a Tasmanian. When we get to like to Australia or New Zealand, when they have like Tasmanian tiger,
mm-hmm.
that apparently was a real animal, and I think it died in early 1900s. But I won't get into that. But I think this they found Pepe in 1876. They're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis book.
Well, what I found was that there were newspaper accounts all the way back to the 1600s when Frenchman named Father Louis Hennepin claimed to see a huge serpent as big as a man's leg and 7 or 8 feet long. However, other people have put it as high as 200 feet long.
Yeah. So, tall tales for you.
Yeah, for sure. And then there's also another one that's popular all across the country, but is also in Minnesota, is the Wendigo. So the Wendigo is a creature that was once a man, and then they ate another human, and then they transformed into a 15-foot-tall shaggy monster with long fangs and glowing yellow eyes that is always hungry for human flesh. And I know they're kind of all over the country, the Wendigo, but they also popped up in Minnesota.
Yeah, they're like Wendigo. It's like much different ways to say it, and it's tons. Like it's hard to find stuff on the Wendigo from like Native American.
Mm-hmm.
Folklore, because they don't really like talking about it too much.
Well, a lot of these are from Native American folklore, so I think most of the ones that I found were from the Ojibwe people. Most of what's up in Minnesota seems to come from their monsters. Like there's a Lake Superior cave monster that dates back sightings as far as the early 17th century. But that one comes from the Ojibwe people. The wolf deer also comes from the Ojibwe people. The thunder horse also. So there's just there's a lot of them that come from that same tradition.
There's a quote from a 1661 Jesuit relations document stated, "Which caused us greater stern was the tellings that met us upon the lake, namely that the man disputed by our conductor for the purpose of summoning the nations to the North Sea and assigning them a rendezvous, or they were to await our coming, had met their death to the previous winter in a very strange manner. The poor man, according to the report given us, was seized with an element unknown to us, but not very unusual among the people we were seeking. They are afflicted with neither lunacy, hypochondria, nor frenzy, but have a combination of all these species of disease, which affects their imagination and causes them a more than canine hunger. This causes them so ravenous for human flesh that they pounce upon women, children, and even upon men, like veritable werewolves, and devour them voraciously without being able to appease or glut their appetite, even seeking fresh prey. And the more greedily the more they eat. The alignment attacked our deputies, and as a death in the sole remedy among those simply people for checking such acts of murder, they were slain or stayed the course of their madness."
That's from the Wendigo, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. I wonder if I found this article about Wendigo psychosis. Maybe you found it too?
No, I didn't find that one. What does that say?
I'm going to go more back. Unless it's characterized by deep raving for human flesh as food, it's also possibly entirely made up judge for yourself. I guess I think it's a psychosis for it. You crave human flesh.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
That's crazy, man.
It's like with like vampires when they try to figure out why people think they're vampires, and they think maybe it's an iron deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that a lot. Or it's a... There's different things, but I have to look it up when I do vampires.
We all know real life can suck sometimes, and your boss accidentally seeing you in your underpants on Zoom last week doesn't help any.
That's why reluctantly codependent sisters, the Shira and Rishalia, keep you enthralled and in stitches every week with their podcast, Legendary Africa.
Every Monday and Friday, we take you on a journey of mythical lands, magical objects, and monstrous creatures, both ancient and modern.
Find Legendary Africa on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you feed your ears. And remember, stay safe,
stay sexy,
and stay legendary.
Do you find the Minnesota Dog Man?
I did find the Minnesota Dog Man. Hang on, where am I? Where was... There we go. Yeah, and the Beast of Bray Road.
Yeah.
Also. And the Michigan Dog Man are all kind of, like, similar. But there was definitely a Minnesota Dog Man sighted in various Minnesota counties.
One in Otterdale County. Let's see. I'll start off by saying that I have never believed in any of these sorts of creatures, but I saw something early in 2009. Oh, 11 years ago. That's not too far. It's not that old. Crazy. It really disturbed me, and it's making me change my mind. I was not under the influence of any drugs, and I have better than average eyesight. And the lightning was nearing sunset, but I was still able to see clearly. So I'll get this underway, explain my story, and maybe someone can shed some light on this for me. I live in Ferguson Falls, Minnesota, which is west central Minnesota, about an hour drive from Fargo, North Dakota. How is it? You ever been there? North Dakota?
To North Dakota? No. I mostly stay in the southwest of the country at this point. But I have been to Minnesota when I was much younger.
How's it, Minnesota?
It's lovely. It was so clean. I went to Minnesota to see my aunt, who owned a bakery up there. We went to a Twins game, and all I could think of the whole time was just how absolutely, like, spotlessly clean it was in Minneapolis.
Nice. I need some, like, bakeries down here in Tennessee. There we go. How was your aunt's bakery? Was it awesome?
Yeah, she was quite famous for her bakery back when she was a cook in D.C. Yeah. And then she was also quite famous for it in Minnesota before she passed. So it's my sister got a lot of recipes from her, and I always enjoy going home because she always makes tons of like amazing baked goods and such.
My mother-in-law is out in the country about 3 to 4 miles out of Ferguson Falls, and I was staying there while my wife and her mother went shopping in town. They called me and asked if I wanted to go to a 7 p.m. movie, so I left the house at about 6:30 p.m. to 6:45 p.m. to meet them at the theater. About 2 miles from their house on a country road known only at the Wendell Road along the Mystica River, I saw 3 white-tailed deer. 2 of deer were rather small, probably just yearlings, and a larger doe, who I assumed was their mother. Me, being an avid hunter, lover of wildlife, and future wildlife biologist, stopped to look at the deer. I also should mention that I hunt in the area and have spent my whole life in the Ferguson Falls area. The deer were following a small creek bed, which is in fact the Mystica River. So there were hardly any trees, except for one. Maybe I didn't see that there because of the tree, but I just noticed something crouching behind a tree in my side of the road, looking at the deer, and to my belief, hunting them. It just sat there, looking at the deer, taking no notice of me, even though I was in my truck no more than 40 yards away, with a clear view, with nothing obstructing my view of it. It had one hand on the tree that was bracing itself. What struck me as shocking was the fact that it seemed like to be a two-legged creature, not a four-legged creature. Its hands appeared to have opposable thumbs and rather slender and long, very unlike a wolf. The creature looked as though if it stood upright, it would be over 7 feet tall. This font is horrible. I can't read it. 7 feet tall, with protruding muzzle, broad shoulders, a slender waist, thick muscular thighs, and being as there was snow on the ground. I couldn't see the feet. He was deep, dark brown in color throughout the body. After several seconds of looking at the creature in shock, the deer ran off. Then something amazing happened. It looked right at me. Okay. Ozdo blaming me for losing his meal. He just sat there, looking at me and blinking, but not moving. This scared the crap out of me, so I hit the gas pedal and drove off. It was very dark in the movie, so I didn't feel like drudging through 3.5 feet of snow with the possibility of a monster-looking area. He was currently looking for a meal that I scared off. So about 10 a.m., I went back there and walked to the tree. Under the tree, there was no snow, so there were no tracks that I could see, but leading up the tree, there were three tracks leading in from my grandmother's law's field, which was hard black dirt. And you can see what Minnesota field looks like in late winter, early spring. You can't make anything out of dirt. The tracks I did find were about 6 to 7 inches in length, but were very clearly canine prints, with the exception of a four-toe looking marks in the snow. That's scary.
Yeah, man, that's crazy.
What a chance, man. That's, what are chances of seeing something like that? That's crazy. Especially like for, I don't know, I haven't seen like a lot of deer lately in my area.
Well, I don't ever see them around me, so.
Yeah. What kind of wildlife do you have down there?
In LA? Yeah. Not very much. Got a lot of dogs, some coyotes. But like, it's pretty much all paved over in LA, so you get some birds, some there's some possums. Sometimes we get a possum. I don't know, mostly it's dogs and cats that roam around. There's a lot of stray dogs in Long Beach. A lot of stray dogs. It's one of the capitals of stray dogs in the whole country is in Los Angeles.
There was that one cougar that was like laying about in the Hollywood sign. Remember hearing about that?
Yeah, there's some of that up in Hollywood, in like Los Angeles forests and such. I'm in Long Beach, so there's less of that less of that around where I am. But yeah, there's a lot of hiking trails, so there's a lot of stuff up there.
How's the food in Long Beach? Is it awesome? Is it
great? It's awesome, man. Especially if you like, especially if you like Mexican food.
Oh yeah, I heard of like the best. What's the best place? Best restaurant there, in your opinion?
And there's a lot actually. If you want all around, there's a place called The Ranch, which has like amazing steak. There's a bunch of, like, you really can't go wrong. You can like throw a rock and hit a Mexican place, and any of them are going to be amazing.
Nice.
So yeah, there's, I don't know, I can't name just one of them, because like there's five around our block and they are all great.
Yeah. What's your go-to meal?
They have this thing called an alhambra at a place that I go to a lot, which is like pick your meat, and then you have and then you get beans and rice and avocado and cheese and such, and it's quite good. I usually do cacheta, which is cheek or tongue, when I go to these places. So yeah, if I have to do something normal, it's usually al pastor tacos. It's usually my favorite, just general all around favorite one from anywhere.
Nice. I've been hungry. Sounds like delicious. Is it another? Sorry. Go ahead.
No, it really is delicious. Now I'm hungry too.
The second story is from another unnamed man. He saw a creature in early September in early year 1999. That's 21 years ago. Jeez. I feel old. on an Air Force base in St. Louis County. He said it looked like a dogman. Here's the email he sent to the dogman encounter site. First off, I'd like to keep my name confidential, just for the fact that it happened on an Air Force base and I don't know who reads this stuff. This happened sometime in September of 99. I forget the exact date. It was early in the month, though. It was between 2 and 3 a.m. I was a security force airman working third shift on base patrol. Now, mind you, this is the Air National Guard base that I worked at full-time. It's on the north side of Duluth, Minnesota, next to the international airport. North to northeast is nothing but large wooded areas. Forest areas, third shift on the base was pretty boring. 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., which and us full-timers worked a skeleton crew, usually only 5 to 6 of us on third shift. I was in the patrol truck doing my usual rounds, checking doors and fence lines late at night. On the north side of the base was usually creepy enough when patrolling by yourself. Anyways, I was on this road driving towards our baseball field when my headlights caught a pair of eyes reflecting back at me. They were almost eye level with me and I was sitting in an F-150. Well, that's tall. Yeah. Around this time, a few of the guys had been seen as huge buck around the property, like a 6-15 pointer or something about around that size. I was about 80 yards or so when I saw these eyes reflecting back at me, so I'm thinking it was a big deer. I gotta see this thing. So I hit the gas and started speeding towards the field. This is where it all happened so fast, it almost hard to explain. There was a little slope behind the baseball field. It sloped down probably around 12 to 15 feet into a brush line. The brush went about 30 feet, then it turned into a thick tree line. The brush was probably armpit high to me and pretty tough to transverse through. Being so thick, as I turned into the baseball field and turned the truck towards the thing, I just caught the rear end of the thing leaping down the slope, below the line of sight of my headlights. The thing was no more than about 20 feet ahead of me when it leaped. All I got a look at was the back end of the thing, and it was big. The best I can do to describe it is to say that it was wolf or dog-like in nature. It had a long tail, longer than 2 feet. The hind legs looked exactly like that of dogs, same with the black paws, but the paws were huge. They were bigger than my hands for sure. The hair, fur was wavy yet matted and thick, like wool. Kind of like wool. It's very Minnesota. Makes sense here, that. It makes very much a lot of sense what he's saying.
Yeah. Right?
Especially like with Minnesota winters. Or mm-hmm. The color is blondish or very. Why is it blonde? They're very. The color is very blondish or very light brown. I didn't notice any gray in it, but this all happened in about 2 to 3 seconds. I sat in my patrol truck for a couple of seconds, confused and thinking, I know what I saw, but it couldn't have been what I saw. So I hopped out with my flashlight and M16 rifle and walked to the edge of the slope. All I heard was a thing running through the woods in front of me, heading in a northwest direction. And this thing sounded like a moose charging through the trees. It made a lot of noise. That's when I started to get really scared, thinking if this is some sort of wolf or whatever, it could be. Or whatever it could be, my M16 isn't going to do a thing to this animal. So I jumped back into my troll truck as fast as I could and headed back on to the south headquarters. I never really told any of my other members about this for fear of ridicule or being called crazy. There's no way I misidentified this thing. I'm a trained observer, an avid hunter, and I work with animal rehabilitation with the Minnesota DNR in the past. I know my animals in the north woods extremely well. So I was like, what I saw, and that was the back end of a large wolf dog thing that basically had eyes level with mine while I was in a patrol truck. The back end was definitely much larger than any of the largest deer or black bears I've seen. At this point, I remember the clear with the tail and back paws, as well as the texture and color of the hair fur. This is my story. I never told anyone. And fear of ridicule. I swear it's to be the truth. I know it's September of 1999.
Crazy.
Hard. Oh, tall is an F1. It's like they're up there. The F1. I don't know if it's like if it's jacked up though.
Right.
Okay. Have you heard about the Minnesota Iceman?
Yeah, I read about that, but it seemed to be just one that someone brought to Minnesota, not like not a local legend. Like it was dead before it came to Minnesota.
Yeah, they found it in like somewhere in Asia, I think.
Yeah,
it's like I heard about it in another podcast, and they're talking about like it could be fake, but they don't know for sure. Cause there was a fake one, and the guy was like a carnival guy, and they made a replica one for take around for shows, and they're thinking, oh, this is the fake one. It's always been fake. Other people was like, no, this is a replica we can take around so the real one doesn't get damaged.
Right. Like
it's interesting. It's probably just like a frozen Neanderthal, like some.
Yeah, probably a Neanderthal or something for sure.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Oh, it's went by fast, man. Damn.
Yeah, man, it's almost an hour.
Did you hear about the haunting of Loon Lake Cemetery?
I did not hear about that.
Let's hear about it. Send a link. Mary Jane Telloger was born on January 5th, 1862, in Border Plains, Iowa. She was the eighth and last child of John and Phoebe Telloger. Terwilliger. John and Phoebe lived long lives, according to her obituary, published in the Spring Spirit Lake Beacon on March 3rd, 1908. Yeah, that's a good life.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you ever... names, do you like... them or words like the language and etymology to your universe you're writing in?
Sorry, you broke up there a little bit. What did you say?
Like when you like making characters names, you try to like make it sense for like the etymology of the universe you're writing in?
Yeah, I try. I can't say always succeed. I try to make all the fairies feel like fairy names, and all the humans feel like human names, and all the Greeks feel like Greek names. I try, because then it helps ground people to know what they can think. And with novels especially, you want people to kind of understand what how somebody speaks, and it's because there's no other way except for like they have to picture it in their brain. So you have to kind of help them along, and having the correct entomology definitely helps.
Makes sense. I like that. I really like that when people like do that, because it's weird when like you have like you're in like a Greek world and someone's name is like Steve, right, for example. It really takes you like out of it.
You know what I mean? Yeah, for sure. And with humans, with Americans, I try to I try to do all of that stuff. This has been real fun, man. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, no problem. Been a blast. Where can people find you?
So if you want to find any of my work, you can just go to russellnolte.com/mail and sign up for our mailing list, or just russellnolte.com/books, and you'll see all of my books. My books are available on any platform, so you should be able to pick them up, whether it's Amazon or Kobo or Barnes & Noble. You can pick them up wherever great books are sold.
Nice. Getting like social media stuff you're on?
Oh yeah. So you can find me on, I mostly hang out on Facebook.
Yeah.
So you can find me at facebook.com/RussellNolte or twitter.com/RussellNolte or instagram.com/RussellNolte. Those are the three places that I'm most active.
Nice. And you gotta come back on and tell me about the series you're working on right now.
Sounds good, man. Yeah, I'll come on when once it's launched next year.
Nice. Thank you.
Awesome, man.
I'll stop recording. Thank you for listening to this episode of Monster Legend Podcast. Or to find more information about Monster Legend Podcast, go to monsterlegendpodcast.com or anchor.fm/monsterlegendpodcast. There you can find all episodes and platforms on which the podcast is on, which you can subscribe to. You also can email me with questions that will be answered on the show. Thank you.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.